Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to DW's Africa Link program. It's Friday, the 9th of March. I am Eddie Micah Jr.
With me, Jane Ayeko-Kumet. We are also live on Facebook. That's DW Africa. On the program today, Zimbabwe's opposition has a new leader. He is young, visionary, and energetic. We asked him how ready he is to face the veteran politician Emmerson Mnangagwa.
It's an election of ideas. It is also an election of times.
Both the US and Russian foreign ministers have been visiting Africa. Many Africans through social media have questioned the timing and motive of the visit. We sought answers from an analyst.
Well, both trips were slightly different in focus. I mean, the Russian one is really about commercial priorities, a bit about defense, whereas the American one is very much about peace and security.
These are some of the stories that we've lined up for you, but here's a chance to listen to some other stories also making headlines.
My name is Jen Nyingi with DW News. After months of a bitter exchange of words, U.S. President Donald Trump has accepted the invitation to meet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The meeting that is set to take place by May will be the first face-to-face encounter between any leaders of the two countries. It potentially marks a major breakthrough in easing tensions over Pyongyang's nuclear weapons program. The European Union has welcomed the planned meeting as a positive development. The Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has met with opposition leader Raila Odinga for the first time since the disputed general election last October. Both agreed to put aside their differences and cooperate in bringing the country together. Raila Odinga boycotted the October 26th election, leaving President Kenyatta to run unopposed. From Nairobi, here is Andrew Wasike with the details.
Addressing the press after they held talks at Harambee House in Nairobi, President Kenyatta and Mr. Odinga said time has come for the country to stop allowing political differences to cause frictions and divisions. After shaking hands, this is what Raila and Kenyatta said.
My brother and myself have therefore come together today to say this dissent stops here. We refuse to be the leaders under whose watch Kenya's lead into a failed nation.
And we have come to a common understanding that this country of Kenya is greater than any one individual.
The two leaders touched on inclusivity of the opposition in decision making.
Andrew Wasike there in Nairobi, Kenya. Now, the United Nations has warned that more than 2 million children in the Democratic Republic of Congo are at risk of starving to death. The UN humanitarian chief will meet donors in the DRC next week to mobilize humanitarian aid for those in need. Here is Jens Alaike, the humanitarian agency spokesperson.
Our humanity should include these people. Frankly speaking, we have a big responsibility in the DRC, also as the UN, also as the NGO community, everybody. We've been there for decades. Now is the time to stay the course.
This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. Now staying here in Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel has warned of a trade dispute between the US and the European Union after President Donald Trump finally signed into law controversial trade tariffs on steel and aluminium imports. President Trump has defended the move, saying it aims at protecting American jobs. Speaking in Munich, Merkel called for the EU to be exempted from the tariff, which comes into force on the 23rd of this month. And finally, a suicide bombing claimed by the so-called Islamic State in the predominantly Shiite neighborhood of Kabul has killed at least 9 people. 18 people were injured in the attack. The attack took place during a gathering to mark the anniversary of the death of Abdul al-Mazari, a leader of the Shiite Hazari minority. For more news and information, visit our website dw.com or our Facebook page DW Africa. My name is Jen Nyingi.
Welcome back. You're still listening to DW's Africa Links program with me, Eddie Micah Jr.
And me, Jane Ayeko-Kumet. Don't forget to check out our Facebook page, DW Africa, for more coverage of the top stories that we've been covering beyond the radio. And we now continue with the program, and that is to Zimbabwe. Now, the new opposition leader, Nelson Chamisa, is a young, energetic and a visionary-sounding man. The 40-year-old intends to run against President Emmerson Mnangagwa on a youth ticket. Chamisa took on the leadership of the country's biggest opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, after the founding father, Morgan Tsvangirai, died at the age of 65. DW's Privilege Mshanri asked him how he plans to lead the party.
I feel honored. I also feel challenged because I'm coming in to take on the vision of our visionary, our icon, the great Democrat, an African statesman, a global statesman, Dr. Richard Morgan Tsvangirai. You know, that has been the face of courage, the face of service and sacrifice, the face of hope in Zimbabwe.
You are probably going to be one of the youngest presidential candidates in the history of Zimbabwe. You at 40, pitting yourself against 75-year-old Emmerson Mnangagwa in the 2018 elections. How do you see your chances of turning the tables and, you know, this swap of generations from 70s to the 40s?
It's an election of ideas. It is also an election of times. We are seeing a competition between the analog generation and, of course, the digital generation is represented by myself. But this is the hope of Africa. What you are seeing is a generation that is seeking to assert itself, but also that is, as you know, seeking to locate exit points. It's a tough one, but the election itself is an election between the good and the bad. We represent the good.
What are these ideas that you think is you coming into the picture? Young people are meant to be having hope.
The first one is the governance platform. You know, just the involvement and inclusion of young people is fundamental. I told you that the future is young. So we need to begin to be very inclusive in our politics, new policies, fresh start, fresh dimensions in terms of involvement of young people in parliament, in cabinet, but in local authorities. So the governance structure, we are no longer going to have young people being looked at as stakeholders, but as stakeholders, people who are able to drive things, not people who should be suspected. And the second level is just the economic, involvement. We want young people to be in the mainstream of the economy. Empowerment, upliftment of young people, they need to be drivers within the economy in terms of various industries, extraction industry, mining, farming. We need to begin to see younger people playing at that pivotal role, particularly in the area of technology. The third issue is the issue of constructing and re-establishing the infrastructure that you then see in terms of the direction that we are taking.
Zimbabwe's newly elected opposition leader, Nelson Chamisa, speaking to DW's Privilege Mshanri.
So, of course, Jane, we posted this on our Facebook page, and as usual, many comments came in. Pakwisi from Kumasi in Ghana says, "Well, I believe that leadership is not about age, but rather competence, integrity, and the spirit of patriotism."
And from Ghana, we go to Cameroon, where Tanwani Effendi says, "If young and vibrant people can start raising concerns for presidency and even taking up the post, it would be great."
Milkat Nelson Chikaba says, "Age is just a number."
And Muningwa Mabaleka says, "I will not qualify a leader solely on age." Those are very interesting comments. Do join the conversation on our Facebook page, DW Africa, and continue sending us your opinions.
Definitely. Now, moving on, President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un agreed to hold the first ever U.S.-North Korea summit. Pyongyang offers to put its nuclear program on the negotiating table if the right conditions are met. The surprise announcement has attracted praise from other key players in the crisis, namely China and Russia. DW's Amrita Kima has been speaking to Aidan Foster-Carter, honorary senior research fellow in modern Korea, Leeds University in the UK, and started by asking whether we should be optimistic or skeptical.
Well, I always try to be optimistic, but there are many reasons to be sceptical. The good first. I mean, we weren't in a good place, were we, for months and months now over North Korea. We had the war of words. We had the endless North Korean missile and nuclear tests. That at least is now all on hold. It's been on hold for the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics. That was the first breakthrough. Now on hold in the run-up at least to this summit, which, if indeed it happens, will be at the end of May. That's all good. It means that things are less tense in the immediate. But everything else, like what they will talk about, who will concede, you're probably going to ask me all this now. I mean, it's very hard to see the way forward.
Is Trump taking a huge risk by meeting or agreeing to meet with Kim Jong-un?
Yes, he is. Trump is so impulsive, it seems that the State Department, whose job, if I remember rightly, is to do foreign policy for the United States, was kept out of the loop. That's quite extraordinary. And yes, he is taking a risk. The North Koreans will have very expert people. They've been a consistent state despite three changes of leader, hereditary, of course, in their case, over 30 years. Trump doesn't read. He doesn't get briefed. He doesn't know anything about Korean history. Much will depend on what special advisor he gets. I mean, he hasn't appointed an ambassador to South Korea. One could go on. So I think Kim Jong-un really holds the advantage in this one, basically sort of has been running this whole process very skillfully.
I'm Rita Shima speaking to Aidan Foster-Carter, honorary senior research fellow in modern Korea, Leeds University in the UK.
Very interesting also there to see the developments between the two countries there. Well, we continue within African continent. Then the Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov and his U.S. counterpart Rex Tillerson have been on the African tour. The two differently met with the African Union chairperson Musa Faki Mohamad at the body's headquarters in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa. Considering the current relations between Africa and the two countries, many have been questioning the timing of the visit. I put this question to Alex Vines, head of Africa program at Chatham House, London. Take a listen.
Look, probably a bit of rivalry of different vision points from the fractiousness of the UN Security Council between the Russian Federation and the United States. But both trips were slightly different in focus. I mean, the Russian one is really about commercial priorities, a bit about defense, whereas the American one is very much about peace and security, and that's to do with counter-radicalization. You can see both these trips with a different logic, that they are coincidental on their time, but they're not directly in competition.
Now, talking about Lavrov, he started off his visit by visiting some Southern African countries, that was Angola, Mozambique and Zimbabwe, before he actually headed to Addis Ababa, where he's been meeting with Mr. Musa there. But how do you see the visit in relation to Russia and African Union, as well as the U.S.?
Well, Lavrov's trip to Southern Africa, that's to do with countries that have previously had relationships with Russia. The Angolan relationship is a deep and meaningful one. The current president of Angola, João Lourenço, did a higher education in Russia. He was at the Higher Lenin Academy until 1982, when Russia was a Soviet Union. The Russians have invested heavily in defense in Angola. There's also mining interests. Alrosa mines, one of the biggest diamond mines in Angola. And indeed, Russia even helped launch a satellite for Angola last year, a telecommunications satellite, AngoSat-1. I think Namibia and Mozambique were about gas diplomacy and mineral resources. The Russians are looking to extend access to uranium, so Namibia is interesting for that. And Rosneft has two concessions for gas now in Mozambique.
I was speaking to Alex Vines, head of Africa program in Chatham House, London. Very interesting there. And certainly that is also a topic that we've been covering on our social media platform, and people have also been talking.
Mm-hmm.
White men will never bring anything to Africa. That is David from Southeast Nigeria. He says, I feel sorry for my fellow Africans.
Interesting one there. Sianda in South Africa says, the support for Africa in having a permanent seat at the UN Security Council will be more convincing. This is a publicity stunt and to show they have power over the continent.
So another one, interesting. Evan Christopher says, we in Africa need all the powers and the superpowers and even their rivalries, quarrels, etc. are supposed to be very good for Africa. If only our leaders will know how to play the games well and just do away with extreme greed, selfishness, looting, etc.
Definitely. Well, also one from Modi Tunkara says, we didn't want them here. Get out of our continent. We have a best friend who will work with us equally, China.
Keep those comments coming. We shall read them as and when we can. We shall be back shortly.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Eddie Micah Jr.
And I'm Jane Ayeko Kumet. Don't forget to join us on our Facebook with your comments at DW Africa.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, Kenya wants to build a wall on the border to keep unwanted people out. But not all Kenyans support the idea.
Right now, the border is open. We have donkeys that goes to that place. Right now, it comes from that place.
And in our African Road series, we bring you a tale of an African girl subjected to disgrace and racism 200 years ago. And of course, it is Friday when we'll be bringing you the latest from the world of sports.
Now, before we go to sports, let's go to Kenya. Now, a wall on the border to keep unwanted people out. The Kenyan government had this idea long before US President Trump. After the attack on the University of Garissa by Al-Shabaab terrorists in 2015, Kenya decided to shut its border by building a fortification. Now, almost 3 years later, it's no longer a wall, but a fence. And not all citizens on the Kenyan side of the border support the huge project. DW's Patrick Grosse has this report by Linda Studd.
Loud chattering can be heard all over the market in Mandera. Customers pass by stalls packed with clothes and shoes, pastries and packet soups, kettles and pots. Jamal is selling household goods. He's surrounded by bowls, baskets and wooden spoons, with almost no space to turn around.
Almost everything we get from that place, everything we got from that place. Percentage, 90% we got from Somalia. We depend on Somalia.
Mandera town is located in northern Kenya, close to the border with Somalia. The only crossing is only a stone's throw away from the market, but so far hardly anyone has used it.
Right now the border is open. We have donkeys that goes to that place. Right now it comes from that place. Even food, everything, it comes from that side. We don't have anything from Kenya.
If the Kenyan government has its way, there will soon be an end to the duty-free and therefore cheap imports. The government wants to close the whole border to Somalia by building a fence 700 kilometers long. It's a huge project that will cost around $1.4 billion, motivated by fear of the jihadist terror group Al-Shabaab.
Our border is really porous. And in the current days, actually there's this terror problems. And it seems this has become an endless issue at a global level and also in our area also. We don't even sleep. So constructing this wall will have a positive impact towards the security.
That's Mohamed Ali Sani. But few people in Mandera share his opinion. So far, only 8 kilometers of the new border fortification are ready, after almost 2 years of construction. Two rows of concrete pillar with barbed wire fencing run through the settlements on the fringes of Mandera. There's also a ditch 3 meters deep to stop cars. Security guard Muhammad Saleh explains the purpose.
This is meant to secure the county of Mandera, which has had a very serious terrorist attacks for a long time. Since now we have done the 8 kilometers, we are being told by the people of Mandera that there is no more attack in Mandera town.
However, the fence is not as impenetrable as it seems and can easily be opened up with wire cutters, as it's not permanently supervised. Town elder Hussein says the project only increases mistrust in the region, as people on both sides of the fence belong to the same Somali ethnic group.
I am married from the other side. My family, relatives are there. How do I allow a wall to be built here? If my mother-in-law dies, I cannot cross.
Or only if he uses the single border crossing. Children will have to go through a passport check on their way to school on the other side of the fence. Nomadic cattle breeders searching for grazing land have to herd their animals for long distances and then force them through a border post.
DW's Patrick Grosse filed a report by Linda Staude.
Interesting that in Kenya, some people like it, some people don't like it. Mm-hmm. But from Nigeria, Ifeanyi says security of the people comes first. It's a good idea. And Ibrahim Jallo from Gambia says in Africa, we don't need a border wall. The African Union should try its best to eliminate extremism in the continent.
Well, Ifeanyi John Micah, that's my namesake, interesting one, that says, I haven't seen any house without doors or windows. Why are global leaders kicking against border walls, yet they all have walls around their mansions? Sad.
And from my country, Uganda, Trisime says, I also support that in order to reduce the number of Al-Shabaab terrorists who enter Kenya and are a risk to Uganda too.
Well, these and many more other comments came through.
Interesting. Now we go to African Roads.
DW African Roots.
She was a servant and a great attraction, a Venus and an exotic freak. She was a woman, and to some, she looked like an ape. Her name was Sarah Bartman, daughter of South Africa. From an innocent life to a life of torment, misery, and humiliation. In today's edition of African Roots, we feature the life of Sarah Bartman, also known as the Hottentot Venus. I did dig into the life of Sarah Bartman, and my findings are now presented by Isaac Mugabe.
Sarah Bartman arrived in London in 1810. She had worked as a domestic servant in South Africa, and her employer accompanied her to Europe. It's unclear if she made the journey willingly or if she was forced. For several years, she was paraded in European freak shows like a wild beast. Crowds flocked to see her large buttocks, earning her patrons a fortune. She became famous as the Hottentot Venus. Hottento was a white name for the Khoikhoi people of South Africa, and Venus alludes to the Roman goddess of love. Those who got to know her spoke of her lively character and brilliant memory. Yet, most Europeans regarded Sarah Bartman as a monstrosity and not much better than an animal. Fundins Mande, South Africa's Commissioner for Gender Equality, has an explanation for the low esteem she was given.
It comes mostly from the belief that Africa is a dark continent and the belief that whoever lived here was subhuman. So those beliefs informed how they dealt with the African inhabitants that they found here, the Khoikhoi people and the San people. The relationships were terrible, and in pre-colonial times, women were not seen generally as decision makers, and it was therefore easy for them to be exploited.
5 years after her arrival in Europe, Bartman died in poverty in Paris. Even in death, Bartman didn't find dignity. She was dissected by Napoleon's surgeon. He described her features as ape-like. For 160 years, people could gape at her skeleton, brain, and genitalia at an anthropology museum in Paris. Her remains were only removed from public display in 1974 after protests. Bartman might have died 200 years ago, but for South Africans who suffered terribly under apartheid, her fate is still significant, says Fundi Nzimande.
She's seen as a symbol of the extreme and horrific violences that people have suffered in situations where they were made powerless, where they were dispossessed. So she's a symbol of the worst atrocities that human beings have ever gone through in the world.
The end of apartheid in 1994 saw a revival of interest in Sarki Bartman. This is the name many South Africans remember her by. South Africa under Nelson Mandela started to fight for the repatriation of her remains. But it was only in 2002 that her body was finally returned home. Her burial in her home province of Eastern Cape put an end to nearly two centuries spent abroad. We can all still learn from Sarah Bartman's story, says Fundi Nzimande.
We are saying never again should any human being have to be treated in that particular way. And it's teaching us that we should honor all people and treat them with decency, regardless of what their gender, is regardless of what their color is.
A tale of an African girl who did not find dignity in both life and death.
That was a beautiful story, though, I have to give it. I particularly paid attention to it. But we'll talk about that after the show. Now, let's move on to some sports news. Now, the Bundesliga continues this weekend as the battle for Champions League spots continue with 9 games remaining. I caught up with DW Sports editor Chuck Penfold to help us preview some of the big games coming up. Now, I first asked him his expectations on tonight's game between second-place Schalke and 16th-place team Mainz.
Yeah, it's pretty tough. It is really, as you say, from second to sixth, something like 3 or 4 points separating them. Schalke in a real dogfight with Dortmund and Frankfurt. So they really don't want to slip up against a team like Mainz, who have had a tough season. So yeah, definitely should be one Schalke need to come out with a win, and I think they can.
Now, third place Dortmund, they will be meeting fourth place team Frankfurt, third, fourth in battle, that is. Both on 42 points, this must be keenly contested game is going to be.
Frankfurt's sort of the defensive specialist. I think their defensive record is second best in the league. Dortmund have been the second best offensive team. So that'll be an interesting contest indeed. As you say, they're even on points.
Exactly. So we'll have to wait to see how that goes. But, well, Hamburger SV, well, they've never been relegated. So is this going to be the time? Most people believe this time they can't survive, especially they're going to the Allianz Arena to play against Bayern.
No hope for Hamburg there, I'm pretty sure. Talking about relegation for the first time, I think you're probably right. I think maybe there was a sign of that this week when they sacked both the chairman, Herbert Bruchhagen, and the sporting director, Jens Todt, which to me sort of was a signal that, okay, we've given up. They've said, you know, for a long time they need to go in a new direction. They're doing that already. I don't think anybody was surprised by the move, but they were surprised a little bit by the timing of it. I interpret it to mean that, okay, that's it. We're planning for the second division now, and we're going to, you know, start rebuilding right now because we don't have a chance of staying in the top flight.
Looks like for the first time Hamburg SV have given up. But well, it will be his 150th Bundesliga appearance, making Timo Werner the youngest player at age 22 to achieve that in the Bundesliga. So it's Mario Gomez against Timo Werner when Stuttgart hosts RP Leipzig. What is likely to win the day, experience or young blood?
I think young blood, in a word. Of course, Timo Werner is also going home. Stuttgart was his youth club and the club he first came up in the Bundesliga with. I tend to think it will be Leipzig. They're a better team. Although Stuttgart have been very strong at home this season. And since they had a coaching change and brought in Typhoon Korkut, that really has worked out the way you want coaching changes to work out, in that it seems to have given Stuttgart a boost. So it could go either way, but I think I would give the edge to Timo Werner.
Now, away from the Bundesliga to the English Premier League, it's second versus third. That's Manchester United versus Liverpool. How is this really going to go at the Theatre of Dreams?
This is it's really difficult to say how this one will go, and that's why we play these games and we look forward to these games. Mohamed Salah, you know, has been going, scoring like crazy for Liverpool. He might be a guy who could make the difference. But it is at Old Trafford, so maybe I give the edge a little bit to Manchester United. But as I say, it could go either way. Should be a good one, and those are the kind of games we look forward to.
That was DW Sports editor Chuck Penfold.
I would like to throw the question that you threw to him, expectation on today's match. You asked him, now I'm asking you, what do you expect?
Actually, I expect Schalke to win. I mean, it's too close to call. It's very tight from second to sixth position in the Bundesliga table. So Schalke really cannot slip up. They want to maintain second spot. Of course, they want to make it for Champions League next season.
And I bet after work, you're rushing to catch your favourite seat.
I would love to watch that.
I hope I can catch a glimpse of that match today.
Please do.
In the comfort of my living room, certainly. Anyhow, let's revisit our top story. People have still been commenting about the young Africans and their roar, like lions, wanting to get into politics and participate. And there have been quite positive comments here. People are still commenting. Charity Taring Kwadike says, all these old people should leave the government for the young people. That's all. Africa needs an overhaul for the future, and it has to be based on the youth.
Exactly. Oswell Mumbama Alpha says the future is in our hands. Let's unite and look forward, and let's support each other, especially the young generation, for a brighter future.
And Turia Zadawa says, Africa rise, new wave of young leaders rising to power. We thank the old generation for liberating us, but now it's time for us to take on. Thank you so much for your comments and for listening to Africa Link. My name is Jane Ayeke-Kumet.
And I'm Eddie Micah Jr.
And from the entire team, have a nice weekend.